All right. Welcome to the Wagon Wheel Podcast, the podcast where we answer your questions on cricket, especially if you sent them in on patreon.com/Jared Kimber. But also, you can do them in the super chats here when we are doing them as well. But Patreon, oh yeah, I forgot I moved all these things. Josh says, how well could a T20 team featuring Afridi, Narine and Rashid Khan, plus Bumrah, Malinga and Dre Russ coexist? Would it be too much spin for a regular pitch? I mean, no, because all those guys are great on any wickets anyway. The only issue I would have with that is you would probably prefer to have someone like Badgery than Afridi, because you would prefer to have someone who is a new ball specialist spinner. That would be the only change I would make to that, just so that you could stretch out the spin a little bit more. But yeah, no, I think that's a fantastic team. They would win some games. Josh says, imagine a hypothetical T20 match scenario. A weatherman wizard has told you it's going to start raining immediately at the end of the power play. To win on DLS, you need to target 60 for two from those six overs. Which four batters all time would you want to win the match? I need 60 from two from those six overs. You would want... would you want Gale, though? Because would you be worried that he would get a little bit stuck at the start? Well, that's interesting, because Gale was my automatic one there. I suppose you would probably go Luke Gronke, because he's the fastest starter of all time. Failed in the IPL, but probably was a much better player afterwards, and they never brought him back to the IPL. But then you would probably go someone like Head or Abhishek or Fraser McGurk, just because of the added power that they could have. If you didn't want to use Luke Gronke, you could also use Josh Butler. Did I say Josh? Did I Josh him? Josh Butler. I don't know if I've ever Joshed him before. That's all I'll do for no one. But yeah, you could use Butler instead of Ronke as well. Doesn't quite start as fast, but I think he could still handle this if need be. And then you could also throw, I think I said Phil Salt as well. At first drop, you would probably have AB de Villiers, and at second drop, you would have Sky, I would have thought. Or Maxwell, probably, depending on... Yeah, I think that's probably fair. Where's my next question? Nadika D. Saram says, Osman Semiyadin, friend of the show, posed the question, is Andre Russell the greatest T20 player of all time? What do you think? So this one, I don't see all the questions when they come in, but this one popped up, and I saw, and I have been thinking about it a fair bit. I mean, Kyron Pollard's a really interesting one because he has a fantastic bowling record, but I think we all know it's kind of junk bowling and maybe not quite as important as Andre Russell's bowling. Sorry, Polly, if you're listening. And so you are looking at an all-round player. Shane Watson's a really, really interesting one just because he had some great years with the ball, but I don't think... overall, he has the anywhere near the cannon that Andre Russell does. Hardik Pandya, peak years were incredible, but again, not the same amount of length of time of that. Same with the spinners. There was a time which, Shakib Al-Hasan, I thought was a really, really fascinating player. You know, automatic four overs. Bats at 4 or 5, would come in and try and whack it on wickets that were spinning sideways. I thought that was really interesting. I just realized there's a question coming up where I was supposed to do like a minimum amount of research and I forgot to send something off. So I think Andre Russell's a pretty good bet on that. Obviously, Sunil Narine's quite interesting. Rashid Khan can give you some hitting as well. You know, and then you've got the single skill players, and do you count AB de Villiers with his wicket keeping and or Josh Butler with their wicket keeping? I think that's quite fascinating. But I don't have a big problem with Andre Russell off the top of my head. Jessica says, do you think it's worthwhile comparing the batsmanship of Kevin Peterson and Andrew Symonds? Both incredible natural hitters, very aggressive personalities. Patience and guile didn't come naturally to them, so they had to work hard and learn how to construct big red ball innings. No, I think they're very, very different with how they go about it. I think that what Kevin Peterson does is essentially game theory. So we did a video this week on TalkSport, which is probably why you've asked this question. A lot of people have been talking to me about Kevin Peterson this week. And one of the things that I think is quite interesting from the way that he played is like when he took on Nathan Lyon at the Wacker, when Lyon was bowling with the breeze, there was a long on out, and KP gets caught at long on trying to hit over his head. And KP is asked about that. And he says, you know, I was trying to hit Lyon out of the attack so that we could tire out the quick bowlers, and the pitch was quite good, and if we did that, we'd be in a position to win. I don't think Andrew Symons thought about batting in that kind of way. I think Andrew Symons more thought about, and Andrew Symons was almost trying to rein in his attacking instincts, whereas KP was trying to let them go at a certain time that suited him, and then just bat normally when he didn't have to. Whereas Andrew Symons is, it's really fascinating with the, I think it was the conversation about Andrew Symons, I think it was with Rod Marsh, but I could be mistaken, but when he was quite young. And Rod Marsh says something along the lines of, so what do you think of when you're trying to, when you're facing spin? And Andrew Symons is like, that I could hit every ball for six. And it's such a different, it's a stuff, such a different thing to think that way. Sorry, I'm just trying to get this research done. Yeah, it's completely different from that point of view when you look at it. So I do think they came at it from very different ways. I do think they did think about cricket in a mode that was quite their own. Do you know what I mean? Like, I do think they went about it from the point of view of, like, this is what best suits me and I'm going to do it. But, yeah, I think one used attack as a way of defending. And I think the other one was natural attack. And if anything, he had to just tamper that a little bit in order to make runs more consistently at that level. Oh, I've said this before. I think I made this video when Andrew Symons passed away. But I thought if Australia had let him be what he could have been, he would have averaged about 32 with a strike rate of about 125 in one-day cricket. And peak Andrew Symons in T20 cricket, probably still one of the things that we lost. If you have a look at the brief games he played early on when he was near his peak, the numbers are incredible. Especially, you know, we're talking about, I think, 160, 170, 180 strike rates in some seasons. I think he played for Surrey, and I'm not sure if he played for any other counties, but he didn't play a lot, obviously. James says, the wrist and finger spinner action, the wrist and finger action of a flipper is closer to that of an off spinner than a leg spinner. With that in mind, have any off spinners bowled one? And if not, is there an obvious reason why not? So an off spinner is going that way. A flipper's like that, isn't it? Yeah, I suppose it's similar, and it's more of a finger delivery. It's always been something with wrist spin, and I think it's more the angle of the wrist. It's almost the opposite of an off-spinning delivery, and so the angle of the wrist would make it even five times more obvious. The other look, I think one day, finger spinners specifically will bowl knuckleballs. I think finger spinners will bowl off-cutting balls, off-spinning balls. We're already seeing them bowl the arm ball again after that disappeared. They've got the undercutter ball. And I think a flipper would be one. But remember, there's really, in the history of the game, probably five people who have ever nailed the flipper to test level standard. And even then, probably not that many have even done it to first class standard, right? It's just not a delivery that people bowl all that much. I remember when the people were like, one of the defenses for all the off spinners with the dodgy actions was, oh, but we'll take the deuce roar out. And it's a great ball. And I'm like, yeah, if someone can bowl the deuce roar legally, I think it's absolutely fantastic. But like, there are some balls that are just almost impossible to play no matter what. And I think that is, you know, a huge part of this one. All right, let's go to, oh, how did I get rid of Ian's question? Ian says, South Africa made the semi-final with seven consecutive wins. Are they better than we thought pre-tournament, or have the circumstances brought about a run that I don't think many predicted? I had them in my top three teams, so I still have them in my top three teams, probably in the same position. So I don't think they're better than I thought they were. Look, it's been a weird run, you know. I want to be on their side partly because I was probably one of the few people who said they had a genuine chance of winning. But like, they're making me work for it. And I couldn't even imagine what it must be like to be a South African fan at this stage. Like, the whole thing is absolutely not. You know, and there's so many different ways of looking at it. You know, when we look at strings of games over a long period of time, if a team has won like four or five close games out of six, chances are in their future, they're going to lose a bunch of closer games, right? Not to say that, you know, there aren't teams that are better in close games than others, But we do see that variance in, especially basketball is one of the best sports of being able to track this. We can see it's a little bit variant. But there are games, there are teams that are better at those sorts of situations because they have the players that suit them. You know, if you have MS Dhoni and you're chasing, if you have Jasper Boomer and you're defending, you know, you should be better in those sorts of situations, right? You know, Australia and Michael Bevan, perfect example of all that sort of stuff. So yeah, I do think Australia, Michael Bevan and Glenn McGrath, I meant to say, because it didn't matter if they batted first or they batted second, you were going to have to go through the end boss, right, to win that game. So just to take all that back, I think South Africa have won a bunch of games that they could have easily have lost. So you either think to yourself, well, that's great, because in the past they would have lost some of these. We would have felt more nervous about them. They would have felt more nervous about themselves and they wouldn't have gone through the game. And then the pressure would have got to them. Or you look at the other way where they think to themselves, we actually haven't played all that good cricket yet. Like, are we actually in form? Should we trust ourselves yet? And I can't tell you what they're doing. I'm not following them around. It'd be really fascinating to be in that change room at the moment to see how they are seeing things. Because I think every player from their 11 or their 12 that they've picked has had really good games. And every one of those players has had an absolute stinker. And I mean, like, it's so dramatic. It's fascinating to watch. Rudra says, how do you feel about Akshar and Jadeja playing in the same 11? I feel like it's worked pretty well in this World Cup, but lengthens India's batting. But I've seen complaints that they're basically the same player. They are basically the same player, but they're like a really important player. So getting two of them means that you bat down a further spot, right? It means that you have batting to number 8 every time, which allows Rohit to play the way that Rohit does. It's the Evan Gulbis effect, Rudra. Come on, you know that. I see lots of people this week when people have been questioning this have been just been saying, have you not heard of the Evan Gulbis effect? I absolutely love that this has entered. We have to have Evan Gulbis teach. I might have to get Evan Gulbis on the podcast to ask him what he knows about the Evan Gulbis effect and what he remembers of that game. So yeah, I think from that point of view, look, it's not ideal. Everyone knows it's not ideal. If you talk to anyone involved with Indian cricket, they'll be like, why couldn't one of them be an off-spinner, right? Why couldn't Jadeja have Akshar's batting, right? Would be exactly what they probably want at this stage. But that's where they are. As they've played the majority of their games probably on the more seamer-friendly pitches and the flatter batting pitches. Let's see what happens when they go up against a bunch of right-handers on a wicket that spins. But I think it gives them extra coverage. It also means that if Jadeja or Akshar bowls a poor first over, they can switch it. And so if you think about Jadeja and Akshar as just one four-over block, I think it works really, really well. And then maybe against Afghanistan, they can do more than that. But yeah, I'm certainly, it's not ideal, and you wouldn't plan it, but sometimes you just have to go with your best overall 11, knowing that there's an overlap there that doesn't quite work. And, you know, if you look at Australia, Australia and West Indies are two really fascinating teams because Australia had Mitchell Marsh, who they basically don't need to bowl in this team, and Travis Head, who they don't need to bowl in that team. Now, both of those guys can bowl very, very handy sixth and seventh over bowling spells, but their skills are almost completely overlapped by another person. Will Jackson, Moeen Ali, very similar again. Slightly different batting positions, but their bowling skills completely kind of overlap each other's. And there's another team. Oh, West Indies. I've said this before. West Indies really want to play Holder, Russell, Rodman, Romario. The problem is, how do you fit four medium-fast, fast-medium right-arm seamers who aren't particularly good at any one period of the game in the same side, right? They all have to be much better at batting. So Rodman doesn't bowl at all for them anymore. Romario, they tried to make into a bowler to do this, and Jason Holder wasn't even in the side, right? This happens all the time. One of the great things about national cricket, really. Rudra says, how do you feel about Ross and Chase's World Cup? I wouldn't have picked him, but he seems to have done really well for the West Indies with the bat and the ball. What makes his non-spinning off-spin so difficult to hit? So I think the thing with Ross and Chase is that if you had told me this is what this World Cup was going to be like, I would have picked him. I thought it would be a low-scoring World Cup. I didn't think it would be this. and so, you know, the way that Ross and Chase plays and the way that he handles spin and he can hit boundaries against spin, I don't think his batting's as much of a liability. If you look at West Indies, they quite often like to have that one guy who just bats like a human, right? And the rest of those guys, they don't mind them being hitters because they're like, okay, but we've got this one guy and he might make 30 off 25, but everyone else at the other end might have a combined strike rate of 200. And we've seen them do that with Marlon Samuels and everything else. If they had their peak Banning lineup and everyone was fit and available, they probably don't need that player, but they generally have needed that player. With his bowling, he's tall and he gets extra bounce, I would say, is the thing that probably causes the most problem. So you struggle. Like if you have a look, he beats a lot of players trying to play the cut shot. And he's very good at getting the odd ball to stop and the odd ball to skid through, which is a brilliant skill to have as a spinner as well. All right, we'll take a quick break here on a Wagon Wheel. And when we come back, there will be more Wagon and more Wheel.
Cricket 8 brings you this show. They are analysing every part of our game. Head over for their watch-alongs, podcasts and articles on what is really happening on the field and why it matters. Cricket8.com is your place for cricket intelligence.
Bloody says, you're currently writing a book about the greatest batters, but not the greatest bowlers. Battery argument, he strikes again. Is it because the greatest bowlers book would be significantly more boring? Especially if we're comparing fast bowlers across eras due to increased physicality, pace, etc. E.g. Jofra Archer on uncovered wickets may literally be lethal. Yeah, you wouldn't want to face him. And it may be recency bias for me, but it's only some spin bowlers of the past who could potentially be considered better than today's bowlers. No, I don't think so. It was... I think I've said this before. The Thinking Basketball podcast did the top 50 batters. They did the top 50 NBA players. And I was listening to that and I was thinking about how you rank batters anyway, which is there's probably a little bit more statistical stuff that we have on batters. And I thought to myself, I wonder if I could do this. And I sort of had an idea of having it as a big podcast series. I think me and Andy Zoltzman were going to do it together. And at that stage, I got called into Bloomsbury and they were like, do you have any book ideas? And I think they wanted to do some of the double century stuff. And then I offered them this and they were like, no, we want this. And so we went with it. Look, we have that book is not going to be out for a year. I think it's some of the best stuff I've ever written. It probably will be by the time I finish my best book ever. And I'm really, really, really happy with the way that the Overthrowing Cricket's Empire, which is the one that's out now, has come out as well. But I think that the Art of Batting, as the other one will be called, is it's just on another level. And it's a topic that I just really interest in. But I wouldn't be any less interested in doing the bowling one. Whether we do batting, bowling, and then do all-time players, I don't know how far we take that series. Probably depends on how many they sell and everything else. But I've got many other books that I've been looking at doing as well. But yeah, I'd love to do the bowling one. In some ways, the bowling one is slightly more fun because if you're doing the top 50 batters of all time, you kind of, number one's kind of done. Whereas I don't think number one is done for bowling. I think it's really, really hard to work out who the top bowler is of all time. I think that's a fascinating place to start with, where with the other one, you're working back from the most predictable number one position pick of all time. So I do think there's a bit of an issue there. But I could certainly do it with that. I would love to do that. You know, all-rounders are really fascinating, but then overall cricketers. How far is Sobers off? Bradman, when you factor in his bowling and Callis and Imran Khan and those guys. I think there's a lot that's fun there. Jessica says, at one point during your Red Inca interview, can't say my own podcast, with AB de Villiers, you asked him, Nasser Hussain said you had incredibly fast hands. How did you build that part of your game? In writing your book, how much time have you spent cross-referencing and double-checking particular information between your different interviewees. Yeah, there's actually a NASA story I was told, which I said back to NASA, and I've been told it many times before, and I've heard it broadcast. And NASA's like, yeah, that one's not true. So I do that. This one probably wasn't that. This one was more along the lines of, I wanted him to talk about fast hands, and I knew he'd had a conversation with NASA about fast hands. And so I wanted him to kind of try and recreate that conversation for me. But to be fair, it wasn't a great conversation with NASA, as one day we'll release the NASA podcast as well. NASA basically said, how do you get fast hands? He's like, I do a couple of these things. And NASA's like, well, that's doing a couple of things is not why you've got fast hands. It's really, I just thought it might be something he might be interested in talking about. That's kind of how I do my interviews, right? You know, I did a really fascinating one with Chris Rogers for the book as well. And Chris Rogers and me must think very similarly about cricket, because the amount of times I would ask him a question and he would answer it with another question that I had lined up for way later. Or he would answer it talking about one player that I wanted him to talk about later on that I didn't even think, you know, he would have in his mind. And so, you know, you are trying to find things that are interesting to them so they will talk. Like, you know, I would have to go back, but my guess is that Bumble, Ian Bishop, Kumar Sangakkara, Rahul Dravid, Jimmy Adams probably all gave me well over an hour. And they didn't give me well over an hour because they're like best friends with me, although some of them are friends with me, right? They did it because they got into the questions. There are other players who I have really good relationships with who gave me 25 minutes. I got enough that I needed off them and it was absolutely fine. Oh, you know, at that point of view. Ross Taylor was a really interesting one because the further we got into the interview, the further we started really deconstructing his career, especially around his eye injury. Absolutely fascinating. And I was giving him live stats on the podcast. And in fact, I gave him stats afterwards as well when we looked it up even further. It's really, I'm just trying to get them to talk. Sometimes what I'm trying to do is get them to elaborate on a particular thing that maybe someone else has already told me. And occasionally, you're right, Jessica, I will ask them something very specific because someone else has told me that and I want to know if it's true. So there's a couple of stories. There was one that I have in the book, which is about Brad Haddon and Mark Waugh talking. And Brad Haddon talked about it on his podcast. And I asked Mark Waugh and he said, I don't remember that. That's fine. You know, Brad Haddon said it happened and that's absolutely fine, but it would have been great if Mark Waugh would have remembered it as well, but that's not how these things always work. Ali says, how would you go about curbing what Gulbuddin did last night? I don't know if you can curb fake injuries, really. I mean, I suppose there's flopping rules in basketball and football. It's very hard to prove if someone has cramp or not. And as a cramper, you know, I would say that if you looked at me sometimes, I would look absolutely broken for a second and then I look absolutely fine. And we saw that with Rizwan and Maxwell. It's hard to tell when, you know, Rizwan was acting and when he was injured, right? And it was sometimes Maxwell looked absolutely fine and sometimes he looked like he was about snapping off. Aditya says, between Steyn and Rabada, who is likely to end up as South Africa's greatest test bowler, or is it someone like Donald or Pollock? I have it as Steyn at the moment. I haven't crunched the numbers. Obviously, you've just put this question up. But I haven't crunched the numbers, but I think that Steyn is the player that I would automatically go with on that. Rabada's fantastic. Pollock was fantastic. Donald was brilliant as well. But I just think Steyn was just that more S-tier level than those other three are. Aditya says, is it possible to buy your new book in India? I've recently bought all your books on Kindle, but the new one is neither available on Kindle nor in the hardcover on Amazon. So at the moment, it hasn't been printed. I think it's getting printed in the next couple of days. So I don't know where it's going to be available is the best way of doing that. But for people on Patreon, I'm going to be selling signed copies directly on Patreon that I will be sending out to people. So I'll put that link up very soon when I hook up my Patreon. Ubik says, what are the fundamental differences between non-professional cricket in Australia and England? And what impact does that have on the national setup? I think non-professional cricket in Australia is incredibly well run. So I'll tell you a story about my kids' under-11 training. So I went to their under-11 training. It was the first one I've been to because the IPL has been on, the World Cup's been on. So I went to one and the coach wasn't there. So I said I'd take over and I helped out. So I got one coach to do one thing, one of the dads to do one thing, one of the dads to do something else. And I ran it like I would run. I ran cricket training when I was a captain and, you know, when I was a kids coach and when I played cricket, and this all amateur level cricket, which was you pick a couple of groups of bowlers, which go in and go out. You make sure that you have your top batters going up against your top bowlers, you know, all those sorts of basic things. But then the rest of the guys are off doing fielding drills, guys and girls in this case. They've got a mixture team in the under 11s. And so they're off doing fielding drills, which are quite full on. And I looked around and there were other more senior teams around not doing that sort of stuff. And I think I've done one fielding drill in my whole time playing cricket in England. You don't have to train to play matches in England. You still get picked in, you know. I didn't even want to play very high. I went out of my way to play high. I made one score in the fourths and they tried to get me back into the seconds or something. And I was like, guys, no. So I never train. No one really does proper fielding drills or stretching or anything beforehand. All these things happen in Australian cricket, even at a lower level, but certainly, you know, on the way up. And I think that's a huge difference that I've noticed is just the amount. And then the games are just taken way more seriously in club cricket in Australia than they are in England. It's staggering how differently they are played. There are some cricket in England that's taken seriously, but it's not, you could play like a fifth. I remember being, 13, 14, playing fifths or fourths or whatever it was. And guys playing like it was a test match. Like, for them, that's what it was. I've never seen that in English cricket. And I've only played in London, so I have no idea what cricket up in the north is like, I should say. Ben says, how do you balance journalistic integrity and reporting on the realities of semi-fixed tournaments with keeping organisations like the ICC on side to keep access to clips, etc., to increase the quality of your content? Is it a balancing act? It's a hard one to answer this. I just do what I do. And if someone's going to have a problem, they're going to have a problem anyway. I've found for years that there were times when I would try and play nice with people and they still found issues. And so I just rub people up the wrong way in administration because I do ask questions and I do think the game could be run better. And because of that, I'm not sure I have the ability to do that. The ICC clips or the clips that we use on the show are used under fair usage. I do have a dialogue with the ICC that is ongoing. And if you watch the second part of this World Cup, we haven't had clips on. So you can tell that that dialogue is going out. But I'm pretty good at understanding fair usage laws now. And I think I have a pretty solid legal case going ahead. And it won't just be for me. I'll hopefully be sharing that with other cricket YouTubers on how they can keep their clips up. And I think the cricket boards around the world are going to have to catch up because it's completely ridiculous, some of the videos that they take down. And there's some real issues to that. But no, I'm going to keep being me and doing my stuff. The thing is that because I actually am a journalist who talks about some of this, a lot of those people also know me. So, they might not be happy with everything I say, but I have some really good relationships with some of those people. I have some horrendous relationships with some of the others. Dan says, the Crick Picks episodes of Wicketkeepers seem to be recorded while you're away. Yeah, Rob stepped in for me. As an aficionado, whose draft selection would you go with? Oh, okay. I've got that here. That was the research I was trying to do before. So the best T20 wicketkeepers of all time. Estelle went Joss Butler, Alyssa Healy, Quinton de Kock. Bayram went MS Dhoni, Adam Gilchrist, Brendan McCullum. Oh, I like that one. Rob Barron went James Foster, Mark Boucher, Michael Bates. Oh, that's a tricky one. Because I feel that Rob was doing this just to troll me. Because he went with two guys I absolutely would have wanted to take. And then he threw in Mark Boucher. I still really like the wicketkeeping in Rob's list more than anyone else's. But I think that overall impact would have to be Bayram's list just because, just before how I go. But yeah, they've got a couple of crick picks lined up. Bayram is actually going to be out. We've got a new show with Bayram coming up as well soon as coming up also. So yeah, there's heaps of good new content. And we have been hammering stuff over the last 3 months. The IPL... finishing two books kind of at the same time, but certainly one book really, the batting book, but also having to deal with the publishing of the other book and everything else. Then the World Cup came up, just little things as well. So we haven't done any double century podcasts in a while, which we'll bring back. We've got a couple of new series with me and Bayram. My next few months are probably a little bit more just normal. I don't know how much I'll be covering the test matches, so I might get some work with the England test matches, which might change things a little bit. But yeah, so things will change quite a bit. But Crick Picks, Rob is absolutely brilliant, and it was great to have him involved. I'd love to do stuff more. People like Rob, Dobell, Zoltzman, Barat, if we can ever get him back, not get him back, but, work out how me and him can make it work again. And there's other people as well that we want to get involved, going ahead. Plus, over on Cricket 8, I've been doing stuff with Mega and Michelle as well. So, we've got some cool things going on over there. There's just a lot going on. So occasionally we will get the Crick Picks gang might be done separately. And, Estelle and Bayram stood in for some of my other podcasts as well. This has been one of the toughest 3 months of my life professionally. Probably outside of maybe making the film or working for a cricket team. I'm still learning with the kind of running a network and everything else. So thank you for still supporting Crick Picks, even when Rob Barron's sexy face was on the screen instead of mine. All right, we'll have a quick break here and then we'll come back with any super chats.
This is brought to you by Cricket 8. Cricket intelligence for you every day.
All right, welcome back. All right. I think we've got everything here. We'll run through the rest. I've taken everything from the main part of the chat. So So I've taken all the super chats and any comments that or questions that I saw come through. But if you still want to ask me a question at the end, feel free to chuck through another super chat. Anurag says, what do you think would be harder for India next year, winning their fifth consecutive Border Gavaskar Trophy or playing against basketball in England? Oh, it's interesting, actually. That's really interesting, that question. It still should be. I know they've played really well in Australia, but it still should be playing in Australia, right? It also really depends on the conditions in England, because basketball is really does need the conditions to be slightly in favour of the bat. No, I think people think it needs to be played on flat pitches. That's not quite true, because that's part of the tactic is to kind of flatten the ball it themselves. But I do think the conditions play a part. And I don't know what the conditions are going to be like, whereas I more or less know what the conditions are going to be like in Australia, and it's going to be a slog, right? And even if they win, they're probably going to have to slog through it again, I would assume. So I'm going to go... I've actually done the World Test Championship ranking, so I've probably already looked at who would win it, but I think I had Australia down as winning 3-2 in that series at the moment, and I can't remember what I had the other series down. So I'll say Australia is slightly harder off the top of my head. Benka says, is the issue with Pakistan that players don't play first class, as a lot of ex-players say? Makes sense for longer formats. How much does affect T20? Oh, Nicholas Perrin's pretty good. Should we check his career tally of T20 games, of first class games? It was 5 for a long time. I think, did he get it up to 8? Oh, no, it's 5. It's still 5. Yeah, it's not first-class career. Look, there is an argument that West Indians have said, which is when the next generation of West Indian players came through, a lot of them didn't play first-class cricket, and so it limited their game, and that really hurts them at the pointy end of World Cups when you have to face Bumrah, and you know you have to face Pat Cummins, and you have to bowl to Travis Head and all those sorts of things. That is an argument, and I think there's an element of truth to that. Like, you probably don't want... You probably want a cricketer. I mean, this is the case of most sports, right? You know, it's the Roger Federer, Serena Williams style compared to the Tiger Woods style, which is you want your child playing as many sports as possible on their way up so that they take all little bits from those different sports and then they use them in the sport you want. Well, cricket is certainly something that we've seen, you know, hockey players and, people with golf backgrounds and all sorts of other, you know, little things, baseball backgrounds and whatever, use those skills in cricket. So we know that that works in cricket as well. But also, the T20, ODI and Test are all 3 different formats. And so you learn things from each. And we're now starting to see things from Test cricket seeping into T20 cricket. Like the wobble ball was a really obvious one. You could argue reverse swing, but that was probably already in one-day cricket. But again, that started as a Test match tactic, right? The arm ball, the leg cutter, all these traditional Test things are coming into T20 cricket again. So I think that does play a part. That isn't why Pakistan is struggling. It's because they don't have good management. They don't have a good board running them. And they don't prioritize making good decisions about cricket. And they change all their decisions every 5 minutes, no matter what they do. That's why they're not as consistent and as good as they should be. Doesn't mean that they can't win things because they still have masses of talent, but yeah. Arco says, would you say that Australia was a bit conservative in picking their team? Should they have leaned more into new crop, especially when it comes to bowling? I think Alice suits their side better than Stark does now, just in the way that they currently play. Not traditionally, obviously. Stark, Cummins and Hazel work really well together because of the way that they mixed originally. But I think right at the moment, you would have to say that that was a bit of an issue. I would have had Spencer Johnson in the side in case Mitchell Stark didn't bowl particularly well. I probably would have tried Xavier Ellis. Xavier Ellis was a footballer, I think, from Hawthorn. I would have tried Nathan Ellis probably more, and I would have had Fraser McGurk. But Arco, I'll be honest with you, I don't think there's a team that I think is probably as, you know, I'm going to be more punchy than almost any team when it comes to selection. I wasn't particularly popular amongst my fellow selectors when I was involved with selected cricket teams because I was always a bit, I was pushing it to the kind of cricket that I wanted to play. AJ, cricket, as most people say, is a sport influenced most by conditions. Is there any other sport which is influenced more through conditions? I mean, would ultra marathon or something like that be one that would come off, you know, off the top of my head, I suppose. Golf is quite, it's not quite on the level of cricket, but golf certainly, you know, links courses especially, Grass tennis courts is another one that's really interesting, isn't it? Over the course, it does change a little bit. It is a bit more gradual, obviously, but it's certainly, you play differently at the end of a tournament than you do at the start. Wet balls in, NFL or rugby or football, any football code really, are always a bit of an issue. But yeah, cricket is rare in that there's so many different things that the conditions can change, as New York showed us. AJ also says, Rishant Hassan is one of the rare leg spinners to come out of Bangladesh. Why is it that they tend to always promote finger spinners over wrist spinners? Is that an indicator of defensive mindset? I think it's an indicator of their wickets. Their wickets are really, really slow. And so it's very hard to bowl wrist spin consistently in Bangladesh when it's slow and low. So if you think of wrist spinners, you think of... You need the ball to spin quite quickly, which is one reason why Australia has probably been a little bit better with that. And also there's a natural overspin, which again brings in Australia. And so I do think from that case, it makes more sense. And, if you've got slow, low pitches, left arm finger spinners bowling at the midway up middle stump is probably your best option. And then off spinners also are going to be really, really handy. Wrist spinners are always going to have trouble. But they have been trying to promote wrist spinners for a long time. Great to see him. He's such an exciting talent. Love him in the field. I love that he's got some batting chops with him as well. Pass says, is Afghanistan giving you Lenka 96 vibes? If yes, I wasn't born, but can you tell us about the events pre and during that tournament to see how history is rhyming? There's an element of the fact that things just kept going in Sri Lanka's favour in 96. Look, beforehand they didn't have remember, Afghanistan have just played in a World Cup where they were really good. Sri Lanka had a couple of games against Australia and West Indies, was it? In 96 in Australia, where they showed some flashes of genius. But even then, it was hard to really work out how that was going to translate to a World Cup. They then had two of their games forfeited, which essentially meant that they were through to the quarterfinals, I think, without ever having to play a game. I think that's right. I know I've written about that before, but I think I'm right on that. So that was very different than Afghanistan, but a lot of things have gone right for Afghanistan. The pitches, certainly. It'd be really interesting to see how Afghanistan would have gone if they got stuck in New York for a little while. The fact that they've got away with only having two batters, and that they've had played some really key games on pitches that really suit them. All these things, they go in your favour. So there's an element of that with Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka was a much better side. Even if Afghanistan win this World Cup, Sri Lanka was a much better side. The depth of their talent, their backup spinners, the ability to have people who could bat as far down as 8 and 9. They didn't have two batters. Right, the two batters everyone talks about from that tournament basically didn't make many runs. The guys who did were the middle order who absolutely changed everything for them. Didar says, isn't Malcolm Marshall still considered by contemporary cricket and analysts to be the greatest fast bowler ever? He's there and thereabouts, yeah. But he's not an automatic number one, Siddharth. He's not Don Bradman. And also, I do think, as time has gone on, I don't know if he's held that as much as he was in the 90s and 2000s. I do think McGrath coming on the back of that, Steyn, Anderson, Warne, Murali, and I know you're talking about fast bowlers, yeah, but all of these things came after Malcolm Marshall, and we saw a lot more of them than these guys, right? Bumrah, Cummins, Rabada. There's a lot of good bowlers that come after Malcolm Marshall. And I think when you go through Malcolm Marshall's numbers, as I've said before, I think he's definitely in that conversation. But his numbers aren't that much better than Curtly Ambrose, right? Joel Garner has very similar numbers to Malcolm Marshall and did it from first change. So the minute you start to peel it away, it's not quite the same. How do you factor in Richard Hadlee, right? So I think there's a few different issues there. I still think Malcolm Marshall is probably, if you asked 50 cricket writers over the age of 30 who the greatest fast bowler of all time is, I think he would get the majority of the votes. I don't think he would be automatic. Right, my son is fascinated with this because with batting it's so easy, and my son's even more about lists than I am. That's all he does, Google in the other room, who is India's best cricketer at the moment, and all this sort of stuff, right? And he's really fascinated with all that sort of stuff. I shouldn't say Google; it'll be on YouTube, but And he gets a bit antsy when we get to fast bowling because there isn't a clear answer, right? Dip Barnes is pretty good. How do you fit George Lohman into this conversation, right? Fred Truman, there have been some incredible cricketers. And so it does get really, really weird and very weird very quickly. Juggling Geek says, does cricket need better dead ball laws? Seen lots of controversial runouts in club games recently on Twitter that come down about it as not thinking the ball was live. No, cricketers need to know the laws better. I think that dead ball laws are about as clear as you can make them, other than the umpire saying that's dead at the end of edge ball. I don't really want to happen, but I suppose, you know, might be the best case scenario. No, I think if you want to know about club cricket, it's almost always, I will say the same answer. Most club cricketers don't know the laws. Most international cricketers don't always know the laws, but club cricketers definitely don't know the laws. My favorite thing in club cricket is when you're playing at a game and it's been raining and it slows down to basically no rain, but there's like the lightest bit of, and they're like, oh, we can't go back on, it's raining. It's like, there's no law that says that. It just isn't, right? If it's playable, you can go back out there. If you think it's about to get really heavy, you might not want to go back out there at that point. So, yeah, I think cricketers should know laws better right across the board. Laws are fantastic. Absolutely brilliant. And they will continue to evolve as they have, as cricket evolves. And there might be other ways to go forward. But no, I've got no issue with the dead ball laws. I've got many other issues personally, but not that. This has been The Wagon Wheel. I am Jared Kimber. We'll be back later in the week. We don't have Red Inkers at the moment, just again, because I've been too busy to record them. They will come back again soon, but we have plenty of other podcasts, as always, coming through. And when the World Cup ends, we'll be able to get back to our more normal programming. But thank you to everyone who's been listening and watching and subscribing and, I don't know, whatever else you do, super chatting and chatting and all those things. All these things make a big difference to me. I'm Jared Kimber. This is The Wagon Wheel. We'll see you again very, very soon.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku, as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.